Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour, August 5th, 2021. As we move on into the second half of this year, is time flying? Are we having fun? Good grief. Tonight I'll be talking more about space travel. So this is getting into some educational material, which I hope you appreciate in these days of everybody talking about everything that, you know, whatever, all the other talking points of other shows. But I'll be talking about something that we should all be thinking about, and that is getting off of this insane planet. Hey, remember the story of Superman? The mild-mannered Clark Kent, as he was disguised as a news reporter. But the story is, the way this began, in the, I think, I don't know if they're Marvel comic books or whatever, back in the 30s, 20s, whenever this was created, but just to give you an idea, people have been thinking about this for a long time, not just now. That's 100 years ago, boys and girls. Anyway, the way Superman gets going is he lives on a planet called Krypton or Kryptonite or something like that. Krypton, something. And so anyway, it's about to explode, and his mother realizes this and in a desperation act packs the baby, who becomes Superman, packs the baby in a spaceship and fires him off to Earth, where the baby lands and somebody picks up the baby and raises him, and he becomes this guy in, like, New York City or some big city, where he becomes a news reporter, but of course he's Superman. So he dons this, you know, he goes into a closet, removes his business suit and his glasses. And it's so funny because nobody recognizes. I mean, he's the same guy, and clearly to everybody watching, Clark Kent is Superman because, I mean, they're the same size, the same face, everything. But Lois, his sidekick at the reporting company, at the newspaper, of course, never realizes this either, which is rather one of the funny parts of the plot. But anyway, the point is that people were trying to get off their planet and get to another planet that was better. And I think there's a lot of people thinking that way right now. And there's a lot of resistance to this. I suggest that all of you read my book, The Diamond Principle. And it is, you know, I was reading some of it the other day because I was doing some commentary for a private group on The Diamond Principle, and I read it, and I thought, you know, this is really, really good writing, and this was published in 2010, The Diamond Principle, one of my major books, and what it does is it summarizes all the books of mine prior to that, and then it goes into a discussion of bubble societies, little societies that break off of the real societies and just move away, and what their difficulties will be, and based on the desire to of the people that control the world to control everything. So anyway, it's a good book to read, especially in these days of severe levels of fascism, government control, etc. Okay, so anyway, just a little bit about Superman there. Some other people, some other planet. And of course, whoever wrote the text, the book of Superman or the comic book, whatever, this was in the human mind. To get off this planet is just nutso, you know, and go to another place where it's nice, you know, and anyway, okay. I'll be talking about Branson and Bezos and Musk's space programs, and I'll be talking about low Earth orbit. Now, Elon Musk is planning to send people up into low Earth orbit this month. I don't know if there'll be any time delays. There usually are. But let me first jump on a topic. A week ago, before my previous show last week, there was an 8.2 earthquake in Alaska, Alaska Peninsula. That's a big shake. I've been personally in a 7. I was in Ecuador many years ago. I don't know how many years ago now. Maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5. I don't know. Can't remember. I was doing some field work there and was near the coast when a 7.0 earthquake hit, and I personally happened to be in the shower at this time when this thing hit, and it was dark. It was dark. So all the lights go out, and this, I'm being bounced back and forth sideways between the walls of the shower as this is going on, and I'm full of soap with the water running and being bounced back and forth, and of course it's slippery in the shower. So I managed to remember where I had put my towel. That was lucky, but I didn't really have time to put it on or anything. I just grabbed the towel kind of out of instinct, and I knew kind of where the door was. And this, I mean, this is going on for a good half a minute or 45 seconds, maybe, a 7.0 earthquake. And so I'm finding my way out of the bathroom area and into a bigger area, which had tables and furniture. And so I'm bumping back and forth, finally find my way outside. And, of course, it's in a small town where everybody is screaming bloody murder. Everybody, you can't hear anything. It sounds like there's no sound that's similar to what people sound like when there's a major earthquake going on. So I'm running into the street where there is some light. It's not perfectly dark out in the street, although it's nighttime. And naked. Excuse me, but I don't think anybody would care given the circumstances. It's like, you know, whatever. If you're alive, that's better than being dead and naked. So anyway, then I put my towel on, and I didn't scream, but I mean, then come the aftershocks. Oh my goodness. So anyway, up in the peninsula of Alaska, an 8.2 earthquake a week ago was July 21st, and I think there was no tsunami as a result of that, but of course that's up in the middle of nowhere where tsunamis may have reflected off the islands and, you know, this low population area. Okay, so anyway, just reporting that with a little commentary. And on to, now, if you haven't listened to my shows for the last couple weeks, I've been talking about space travel, and this week I'm going to go into a little bit more detail and also make a slight correction here, because I talked about the energy of an object and the kinetic energy, which you have to dissipate when you're coming back in from outer space, is equal to 1/2 mv squared. So it's the v squared term that's the difficult one. So if you come into the atmosphere going twice as fast, you have four times the kinetic energy to dissipate. If you come in five times as fast, which is, or maybe six times or seven times as fast, which is the case, the difference between, say, what Branson did at a couple thousand miles an hour versus the something coming in from orbit, which is 17,000 miles an hour, that's a difference, really, of about almost 9, or let's call it 7. Just I'm using round numbers here. So that's 7 squared. That's 49 times the kinetic energy that you have to dissipate. So coming in from high speed, any time you come into Earth's atmosphere, you want to slow down as much as possible before you re-enter, which means retro rockets. And if you're using retro rockets, that means fuel, that means weight in a spacecraft, and every ounce of weight is payload. So that, and I already talked about the rocket problem. I'll just repeat the rocket problem for all you out there that may have missed this. Very, very important when you see a rocket go up with a payload. Let's say you have a very well-designed rocket. It works very well. It has a certain payload capacity to get up into orbit. And you want to add 1 pound, one measly little pound. You want to put a chicken on the spacecraft, or, you know, a little teeny, a couple of mice. They weigh a pound, whatever. You want to add a pound of payload. Now, of course, you need some more fuel to lift that extra pound, but now you need more fuel to lift the fuel that you need to lift the extra pound. So you can see what's going on here. It grows and grows. If you want to double the payload, now you have to add more fuel to lift that, etc. And so it's a process, and also the structure of the rocket grows on and on and on. And so the difficulty, the size of the tubing that you have to use to make the rocket, everything increases in difficulty as you make it bigger. And of course, that's why people have figured out if you can miniaturize the satellites, then you can send up lots of them to do individual tasks, and of course have low power, so you don't have to have this mammoth amount of energy up in outer space. All of a sudden, you can launch a lot more things. Anyway, it's called the rocket problem. And it's a limitation because, say you want to go to the next star system, and you have to take you want to go via rocket. Even if it's a nuclear rocket, you're going to have to take nuclear fuel and the stuff that you heat up with the nuclear rocket to blast out the back end. These are inertial engines. They are called inertial engines because inertia is what you use. You push against one side of the rocket out the rocket cone, the engine cone of the rocket, and then your rocket goes in the other direction. That's Newton's law. Equal and opposite reaction, and something moving in one direction makes the other part of the object move in the other direction. So the basic physics, kind of 101, back to Isaac Newton. So anyway, the rocket problem is what prevents man from getting into space. So, but there are solutions. There are solutions. And I've come up with those solutions. And of course, back in the early 2000s, I gave a very famous, now quite famous, I would say, internationally, talk at the UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada, called Electric Highways to the Stars. And of course, based on my understanding of the electric nature of the solar system, etc. Okay, so anyway, now I'm going to jump into, and by the way, I'll be quoting from the Diamond Principle here, about different aspects of going into outer space. So anyway, I'm going to jump into this topic right now. Just quick, a little bit of selfless promotion here. My water filters are on sale on the webpage. This, and what I'm promoting now is the MR5. These are the whole house water filters. And I'm very proud of the development of this particular device. It's a unbelievably high quality. I mean, this is ultra high quality stuff. Stainless steel container with five big, this is my new HI technology, 20 inch filters, and to really clean up your water. I mean, I'm not going to go into this on the air, but you can go to the webpage, read all about it, and also you can order as an extra option, which pretty much everybody is ordering that's ordering. Orders the UV filter in these days of bacteria and virus, etc. It's a post filter, and it's the best on the market. That's all I will tell you about that. But anyway, jmccwaterfilters.com is the webpage. And then if you want to look at my wing generator and everything else, jmccsci.com, seven letters, jmccsci.com. And you can get to the water filter page from there. Okay. So on with a discussion of kinetic energy and re-entry into the atmosphere from orbital velocities. Excuse me, I do have a couple quick items here to talk about first. One is the number of Tesla fires recently. If you noticed in Australia, there was a massive fire that burned out an entire installation of Tesla. Mega batteries. And these are, remember that a long time ago, Australia was having problems with its wind energy and solar energy, that it was not balanced, that sometimes on a windy day they'd get this tremendous surge of energy and that would blow out all the electronics of everything because they would get these surges that they could not control. And, of course, that's the issue with standard alternative energy, and the same with solar. So they'd have a sunny day, and all of a sudden, or a windy day, and all of a sudden the wind would die down, in the Edward brownout. That's when you have underpower. That's what happened in Texas. And so, once again, it ruins a lot of electronics, especially three-phase motors and other types of, like, DC motors that are used in industry. It's very bad for your television, computers, etc. So it can burn them out by having low power. And that's why everybody in their house has a UPS, and that's why I say that the unwritten rule is that the central power should company should control the power and the voltage level, and they should not. Because everybody out there, everybody listening, I bet you $1 million that maybe not everybody. Maybe if you're a little more primitive, you don't have one. But I bet almost everybody out there has a UPS. It's a thing to control surges of electricity in your house and can protect your computer, TV, anything of value. You probably have a UPS. I know I've got a bunch of them. I couldn't even count how many I have. You know, and they're $100 a piece or something. So easily you have many hundreds of dollars in your house on devices devised to protect your electrical equipment in your house. And this is the reason. So anyway, Tesla comes along, Elon Musk, and he boasts, okay, I'll put these in. If they're not in within a certain amount of time, I'll give them to you for free. He says this to Australia to sell his big mega lithium-ion battery packs. Okay, all is well and good, but the other week, what, a little over a week ago, maybe one of these catches fire. And all it takes is one little lithium-ion little microcell. And what a lithium-ion battery is, it's different than, say, let's look at a battery that is in your car. It has liquid, and there's a certain rate at which the acid and the lead in the battery can interact to create charge, and therefore when you put a load across or a wire and load across the battery terminals, it can only produce at a certain rate. It'll give a big discharge, but ultimately that's because there's energy stored up in the battery. But internally, this is the point, internally there's nothing that's going to It's very slow. The battery self-discharges very slowly. The gel batteries that I sell with the wind energy systems, the wing generator, etc., are gel batteries, and they have an extremely low discharge rate. That's why I love them. One of the dozens of reasons why I love gel batteries. They're very stable. They have a very low discharge rate internally, and they don't even have a hazmat code. They're so safe to ship. You can ship them with clothes or baby toys or anything, anything that you can imagine, toilet paper you could ship them with. There's no hazmat code because they're so safe. They're not going to internally discharge. But a lithium-ion battery is totally, totally different. It's going to, if one of those little cells internally discharges, breaks down, then that's going to create heat that's going to cause a spontaneous reaction in the next cell, causing it to break down. And when this happens, it's like nuclear fusion. It's like the one atom going off creates the next one going off and the next one going off, and that one creates two more going off, and that creates four more going off, and then this thing just cascades. And once they start burning, they're set up next to each other. So once one of the mega batteries starts burning, all of the other ones in that cell are going to burn down. And it took, well, let me see, what was the statistics here? It took 130 firefighters, 30 fire trucks, 13 tons of lithium-ion batteries, and it took them 4 days to control this thing till it finally, they didn't put out the fire, it burned itself out. And imagine all of the pollution from the firefighting foam. Remember PFAS chemicals? It's in that firefighting foam to try and calm the fire down. And then the lithium-ion batteries are tremendously polluting. So what you're going to get here is an enormous, enormous amount of pollution. So all you greenies out there jumping up and down, we're going to save the world, climate change. I keep pounding on this, until there are real solutions, and my wing generator does not require batteries. That's the thing, and you know, it's being held back so much. Anything that does not work, any stupid little invention, there's a guy that's got a, you know, like you go, sometimes there's a special at a gas station and they got one of those balloons up in the air and it's flipping back and forth. It's in the form of a man or a guy with a 10-gallon hat on, and it's a balloon. And it flips back and forth in the wind. Well, there's a guy that's got an invention that it's supposedly going to generate electricity. Well, is that going to solve the world energy problem? No. It produces a little teeny weeny type of energy, but it's getting all this press. Oh, you cannot turn a page in the rags out there, the alternative energy media. Oh, it's going to save the world. No, it's not, and it's getting all the press. Why would the wing generator not get any press? The one thing that's going to work, because that's why it's going to work. It's going to work, and the world is, you know, electrically doomed to failure. So, you know, eventually it's going to come into play. But everything that doesn't work gets funded, big time, millions and millions of dollars, millions of dollars, billions of dollars into things that don't work, and all kinds of publicity. Yeah. But anyway, everybody that's out there jumping up and down, climate change, we're going to save the world. Then you put in something with a rush because, oh, isn't that wonderful? And it's a technology. Now, a long time ago in my own business selling wind energy equipment, I had to sit down and have a discussion because I can buy any battery I want. I can buy lithium-ion batteries, but I don't. I once had a discussion with a truck driver. Now, here's a guy who gets a hold of me, and he says, I got a semi-truck, and I want to put batteries in it so I can sleep at night, have air conditioning. And he's a long-haul trucker, you know, and he wanted inverters so he had all the convenience, could make his own coffee, fry his own eggs, everything with his batteries in his truck. And he was going to put in lithium-ion, and I said, lithium-ion, it's kind of hard to say. Lithium-ion batteries in his truck over the cab. And I said, it's not a good idea. Not a good idea. I would highly recommend you put in gel batteries because they're safe. Now, let's take another, and he did, by the way. He took my advice. Here's another couple is sleeping in their house in California. They got two electric cars in the garage. One of them is a Tesla. I think they might both have been a Tesla. And they're charging overnight. Now, the electric car companies that are out there, there's Audi, there's all of them right now are selling electric cars, have sent and issued proclamations and warnings to the owners of these vehicles saying, do not leave it in your garage fully charged overnight. Do not leave it plugged in overnight. And that's the whole selling point is while you're sleeping, your car is charging from the electric charger in your garage. And when you wake up in the morning, your car is fully charged and you go out and you get in, drive away. That was the selling point. That's the whole purpose. And then they come back and they tell them, don't do that because this baby could go up in smoke. Well, one couple in California, that happened. Their car self-ignited in the middle of the night. And these are happening all over in parking lots, etc. Imagine you're in crowded traffic on an LA freeway. If you ever been on the LA freeway when it's crowded, there ain't no way, there's no place to go. And say the car next to you, or in front of you, or behind you is a Tesla, and that baby goes up in smoke. You're there, buddy. You better get out of your car and run as far as you can and get away from that because it's going to take out everything in sight. And the gasoline cars are going to go up, and once it hits the gasoline, those babies are going to go. In a New York second, in a flash. So, yeah, people are driving around in bombs. There was the guy a number of weeks ago. He's driving down the street, right, leaves his home. He's in his Tesla, brand new, just picked it up, brand new Tesla. And all of a sudden, he starts seeing smoke. So he tries to get out, and he can't get out. He finds a way to get out of this car because it's self-locking, you know, intelligent car. Oh, my goodness. Is this bat crazy or what? And he gets out. He gets out before this baby goes in flames. He's seconds away from being incinerated. And then there's a couple that was driving and there was a crash and the Tesla battery shorted out and whoom, two people And I was amazed when I read the autopsy. They said cause of death unknown. Was like, wait a minute. These people burned up in a car. Cause of death, fire. there's, and excuse me, this is a bit graphic, but there was really nothing left to do an autopsy on. Cause of death, fire by Tesla batteries. Okay, so enough of that, but I mean, here's what happens when you have a rush. It's like a rush to judgment, a rush to decision, a rush to do anything, a rush to get married, whatever it is. It's a lot of times not a good decision, rushing to do things. So rushing to install $10 trillion worth of alternative energy is not a good idea because the technology has not been refined to the point. If the technology were refined to the point where it were workable, then the government would not have to put any investment in it. This would be economically viable. It would be profitable, and every investor on the planet would be putting money into it, right? Yeah, because you got, I mean, this would be taking over oil industries. All the oil investors, all the big, big, big investors in the world are invested in energy. So why wouldn't they invest in something? But they're not. Warren Buffett's putting money into three-blade wind turbines because he gets the subsidy. He gets the subsidy the first year. The next year they sell it off to some secondary company who gets a subsidy. And then after 2 years, they sell it off to a third company who gets a subsidy, you know. And so all they're in it for is the subsidy. And, you know, this is ridiculous. So you're paying for junk that doesn't work, three-blade wind turbines and solar panels. I just saw, you know, there's another issue of counties, like in Ohio, they passed a law preventing or allowing counties and local municipalities to turn down alternative energy projects. And that was never there before because it got approved at the state level. And the little county or the little municipality had no say in this thing. Somebody would come and they'd be putting in this stuff in their backyard and no ability to stop it at all. Well, in Ohio, controversial law allowing the local municipalities, local government entities to stop installation of this crap that doesn't work. Okay, so anyway, and then just another note, very important topic. The wildfires in California raging out of control. It's the fire season, the dry season, and the hot season. And, of course, people are going, oh, the high temperatures in California prove global warming. Well, no, it's, you know, you can't take 1% of the surface of the planet and extrapolate that to the rest of the planet. Because if you go to Brazil, they lost a coffee crop because it's snowing. Yeah, sunny, warm, tropical Brazil, it's snowing. So the average temperature of the earth is actually lower. And they lost their entire coffee crop and most of the tropical regions that grow coffee have lost their coffee crop because of the cold and heavy rain. And why is it raining? Because, you know, whereas it's very dry in California, it's raining because now it's winter. If you aren't familiar with the world and how it works, it's winter in South America and in the South Pacific. And most of the southern end of the planet is water. There's very little land down there. Most of the land on the planet Earth is in the northern hemisphere. But in the winter, the wind currents bring the cold air up from the south. And then you have the warm, water-laden air coming in from the Caribbean or from the equatorial region of the Pacific Ocean, whichever the case is, whichever way the trade winds blow at that location. And it meets with that cold air and the water dumps. So it's raining, raining, and raining, and it's a very cold winter. So the lack of sun, the tremendous amount of rain, and the very cold weather has made it extremely uncomfortable for people in the Southern Hemisphere. But nobody talks about that in Western press. And then you have fires in Athens and Crete, Turkey, tremendous dry fires where it's been dry. And as soon as the least little match hits, you know, somebody's milking the goat and it kicks over the candle and burns down the whole region. So these tremendous fires are raging outside of Athens, on Crete. People have been saved from the beach in boats. They're fleeing in boats as from the beaches, the tourists and the residents, because the fires are coming in. When they come back, everything is burned down. But the other thing is, it looks like somebody's at work with laser-guided things to initiate the fires. Because you see the same thing that was happening in California, where you have, actually the trees are not burning, but the cars are burning up and the houses are burning up. You know, is somebody busy around the world destroying stuff? There are people who revel, who are in charge now, who revel in destruction and death and suffering. They love it. They get a rush off it, just like when you hug a baby and the baby is making little cooing noises, or when your kids succeed or you get you buy a new car and you're happy, you know, or you buy a new house and you're happy. You know, that's your happiness because you feel it. You feel like, oh man, you've reached a goal, you've accomplished something, you have something that's really going to make your life better in some way. These people get that same feeling off of death and destruction of other people. These are the people running the world now, boys and girls. That's how they think. They wear suits, they go to meetings, they look like they're very responsible people, but that's how they work. That's the way they think. They get a rush off of suffering, of watching little kids suffer. Yeah. These are deranged, distorted people. And they're in control of the world, and they're also in the military, especially the U.S. military is rampant with people with these disgusting characteristics. You know, the old James Bond movie would have people like that, and the villain was somebody that would revel in the destruction, you know, and have a laser beam or whatever it was. And they would revel in this, and that was just showing that psychological trait of some madman with too much money. And I think we have a little bit of that going on right now. In fact, if you look at some of the rich characters on the planet, they actually resemble characters from the old James Bond movies. Okay, enough of that. One last little comment here. It was announced this past week that one of Einstein's predictions was now proven. Well, it was not proven. And what they were talking about is behind black holes, objects beyond black holes, the light that's beyond the black hole, being generated beyond the black hole, curves around and then is viewed as, it's called lensing, gravitational lensing. It's not gravitational lensing. It's due to the induced electric dipole redshift around electrically active stars. Okay, so anyway, once again, bad science being pawned off on the public, and it just never ending. The bad science that's coming out of NASA or the standard science community, astronomy, astrophysics, space science, just absurdities. But it'll never end, and that's been going on. The old general relativity, Big Bang stuff has been going on since well over 100 years. So if you think that's going to end anytime soon, you're just fooling yourself. Okay, so off to reality, back to orbital dynamics and kinetic energy of reentry. That's tonight's science topic on The Real Science Show, where you get this. Now, let me just ask yourself a question. Where are you going to get this information anyplace else on any other radio show? You're not going to hear it on Hannity. You're not going to hear it on Tucker Carlson. You're not going to hear it on, well, I just won't even list all the other places where you won't hear it, because the only place you're going to hear it is here. Okay, reentry using the aerobraking model, and I'll talk about the other ways of coming into the atmosphere so you do not have this issue. And so let's look at something everybody's familiar with, the space capsules of the Gemini and Apollo space programs, and that's something they did do. They came back in the atmosphere. The Russians have this down to a fine art. They come into the atmosphere all the time. But the very first thing you do if you're in low Earth orbit around going around the Earth is you fire a retro rocket. In other words, you position, there's little, you could kind of liken it to these jet motors that are on boats. A big boat or ship has little motors that push the water sideways. They're typically a jet type of motor, and it pushes the boat sideways so it can turn around in without going forward. The typical way of turning a boat is you go forward, you turn the rudder, the boat goes in a circle. But in a lot of places with a great big boat, you don't have that kind of space to turn around. You don't have space. You know, a big ship on the ocean can take miles and miles to turn around or to make a turn. Okay, so anyway, the spacecraft has little retro rockets in it also to position it. And even if it did not, the point is you have to have a retro rocket. You fire it in a direction to slow the spacecraft down. And once it slows down, it starts to drop out of orbit. So then it's going to drop into the atmosphere. And so that's why I was saying, if you're coming in at 17,000 miles per hour, that's the orbital velocity. That's what keeps you in orbit. As you go in a straight line, gravity's pulling you down. And that's the balance between gravity pulling you down and your momentum keeping you in a straight line that keeps you in orbit, basically going around the planet. And that speed is around 17,000 miles per hour. That's the orbital velocity you have to achieve to get into orbit and maintain an orbit. So to come out of the orbit, you have to get rid of that velocity. So the first thing you do is you fire a retro rocket. And looking at orbital velocity and comparing it to say Mach 1 or Mach, let's see, I think I was last week I was doing it with Mach 2, and that was the speed that Branson was using as he reentered around 2600 miles an hour was the max that he would have achieved before he hit the atmosphere and started to slow down. But the 17,000 miles an hour, so when you're retro braking, you're starting out at 17,000 miles an hour. That's almost nine times 2,000 miles per hour. So in terms of the kinetic energy transfer, remember it's one-half m the mass, v velocity squared. One-half mv squared is kinetic energy. So that's that v term, which is the bad one here. And that's because it's squared. So the velocity squared, if you're going twice the velocity, then there's four times as much kinetic energy. If you're going three times the velocity, then there's nine times the kinetic energy. It's squared. It's a squared term. So if you're going, in the case of 17,000 miles an hour, you're going about nine times the velocity of what Branson was doing when he came in. So that would be 9 squared is 81. Something coming in from orbit has 81 times the kinetic energy to slow down than what Branson did when he was coming out of just low Earth trajectory, going up to zero velocity and coming straight back down. So you can see it's a big difference, a big, big difference. Now Elon Musk coming up is going to be going into orbit. So he has all of this other baggage, so to speak, to deal with in going into orbit, much higher velocity, and then coming back out of orbit. But and of course, what they do is they build the spacecraft so that it, no matter how it hits how it hits the atmosphere, it's going to turn so the heat shield is first. And so that's kind of a natural thing. It's kind of like an arrow. If you shoot an arrow out of a bow, an archery bow, it's got the feathers at the back, and that arrow is going to go straight because number one, it's the fletching, it's called, the feathers on the back of the arrow are twisted, so the arrow is going to turn. So that gives it one stable point rotation, and then, or it's called gyrostabilization in the technical term. And the other thing is that the feathers are at the back, so as the arrow goes forward, it's going to keep the arrow pointed in the direction it's moving. Okay, so it's spinning, and it's got the drag at the back end, and so the spacecraft is designed similarly so that no matter how it comes into the atmosphere, it's going to flip around So the heat shield is first. And then that heat shield is built thick enough, and it's a ceramic. It's a ceramic material, very hard ceramic material. And it comes back into the atmosphere and is burning off. And there's enough of it there, so by the time it gets down to the point where the parachutes can come out and it's slowed down, then there's still some heat shield left. And then you just replace that heat shield, and you could, technically, you could reuse the spacecraft, although I don't think they do. And that's one of the things that Elon Musk and all the others are trying to do, is build reusable space equipment, something NASA never did, because, hey, when you're spending the taxpayer money, you can burn it up, not a problem. You can build more. And but if you're dealing with a private company, then reusing makes economic sense. So there's an economic and ecological reason. There's many reasons for reusing a spacecraft. Just like we reuse airplanes, we reuse pans that you cook with. You don't throw it away each time. It's an expensive piece of hardware, and it makes sense to build it so that you can reuse it. That's just the way it is. I mean, that's common sense. But like I say, if you're NASA with the government budget and no problem, the public is paying for it, hey, economics is not a factor. And you throw in the additional thing that NASA's whole modus operandi is to keep you from going into space and make it as expensive and difficult as possible, then you understand that the whole space program was built on that premise. That's not what they tell you, of course. Okay, so when you're coming in at orbital velocity, you have to burn up. Now, when you do the retro burn, you're probably getting down to around maybe 14,000 miles per hour before you start dropping into the atmosphere. So you've already cut 3,000 miles per hour off, and that's, last week I said, seven times the velocity of what Branson was doing coming back in. So seven times in seven squared is 49 times, and that's where those numbers came from last week. I kind of ran out of time. And so even at that, it's 49 times the energy that you have to dissipate if you're coming in from orbital velocity compared to just going up and coming back down. Okay. And so I should throw in a little bit of a caveat here, because people have been talking about the space elevator. Now, let me explain this. And this is, you're used to getting in a building, you get in the elevator, you go up to the top floor, and or whatever floor you're going to, you get out of the elevator and you're at the top floor. Very nice. But that's not the way things work when you're going into outer space. When you go into outer space in an elevator, what's going to happen is, as you go up, there's going to be a force. It's going to be kind of an artificial force, but it's real. And it's going to be pushing you backwards. Because say you take a line radially up from some point on Earth, and that would be your elevator. As you go up and then you get out to the, say, orbital position at out of the atmosphere, etc. Okay, now you're going, because of you have to be in orbit, you would have to be going at an orbital velocity to stay in orbit. So that means you need a lateral component of this of 17,000 miles an hour. The space elevator does not contribute this. And this is just rotational dynamics, and it's going to have a force against you in the opposite direction. So it's going to be pushing you back also. This is orbital dynamics. This is what people don't understand. And so the little Trekkies that are running around going, oh, space elevator, they think that once you just get in the elevator, you go up and, hey, you're in orbit. It's not the way it works, because you're not at orbital velocity. And so you need another component to make you go into orbit. So people don't understand this. They have this Mickey Mouse, you know, Flash Gordon view of space, where the spaceship goes up and it's in orbit, right? Now, this is why they use rockets. Because the biggest part of getting into orbit is that lateral component. The first part, the reason you need that big, big rocket booster is to get you out of the thick part of the atmosphere. And then you lean over, and then you have the lateral component. And most of the time, you are going up, but laterally, and literally when you get downrange, the rocket is almost horizontal, and it's pushing it to get it into orbit, and that's what you're doing. You're giving it that orbital velocity. And there's a little bit of an angle up, and so the rocket is really doing two things. It's making you go farther away from the surface of the Earth, but most of it is pushing you in the radial, lateral direction to push to insert you into orbit. This is not what a space elevator does. A space elevator, you just go up, and you're in outer space, but you're not at orbital velocity. Well, how do you get at orbital velocity now? If you tried to go laterally now, then you'd fall back down long before you ever got into orbit. I mean, it's people. But here's the problem. And even trained physicists, I've seen people write, and they say, well, I write an authoritative paper on this, and it was published in a peer-reviewed journal. It's like, oh, my goodness. These people are in la-la land. They don't understand basic physics. Physics 101. This is basic. And so to get into orbit, you need some energy. You need energy to bring you up. That kinetic energy that you're doing, the 1/2 mv², 17,000 miles an hour, that's a lot of kinetic energy that you have to put into that. And that takes rocket engines. And really, there are other ways to do things if the spacecraft is very lightweight. Okay, that's a different story, and that's the case with Branson. They're using aerodynamic lift, but there's a limit to what you can carry and what you can put into orbit with a runway to orbit scenario. There's because of the limitation. But you can do it. It's an interesting physics problem. Let's take a look at, a 747, gets up to 45,000 feet cruising altitude. This baby weighs a lot of, there's a lot of weight, and so you technically could take a rocket up with an airplane with, you know, standard technology that we have today for jet airplanes and take up a heavy, very heavy payload to 60,000 feet with the air-burning engines, and then launch from there, and you would have a reusable launch vehicle where you could get heavy payloads into space. But nobody has gone there yet. It's some place I would like to go with the technology someday and put objects into orbit that way, because then you'd come back down, land, pick up another load, take it up to 50,000 feet, launch it. You could do that all day long. And, as far as the jet fuel is concerned, it's not very much. That jet can hold enough fuel to fly halfway around the world. So just going up in this location and dropping off a payload and then coming back down and landing, it doesn't take much fuel at all for the jet plane. And so anyway, that's also the basis for my hotel launch system, which you can see on my webpage, jmccsci.com. And also the other issue with a space elevator, by the way, I talked about this last week, is that you're putting something in the middle. And I have a funny story after I tell you this. Okay, so you're putting something from the ground of the Earth, and that's the whole idea of this elevator is tethered. It's somehow attached. You drill big holes down in the Earth, and then you attach this structure, and then it's like a cable that goes out into outer space. Well, what you're doing is you're discharging the vertical electric field. So you're going to have a real big problem because all this energy is going to come down that path. The reason that does not happen normally is because the atmosphere of Earth is a dielectric. That's something you put in a capacitor to raise the capacitance, its ability to hold charge. So the Earth's atmosphere is a wonderful, wonderful dielectric. And that's why after a lightning bolt, the lightning bolt is very fast and the dielectric comes back, fills that space and prevents more lightning from coming back down the very same spot. And that's why, by the way, they say lightning does not strike twice in the same place unless you're under a tree out in the golf course. And that's one thing, too. People that are golfing, it's the golf season. If the storms roll in, do not get under a tree. That's the worst place to be. A lot of golfers get killed by standing under a tree, just like cows get killed standing under a tree during a lightning storm, because the tree is up high. It's like a finger. It's like a electrical path sticking up in the air. So that's where the lightning comes. It hits the tree. The current comes out the roots that are out sideways at the base of the tree, and then that goes out through the ground. And that's what, by the way, Tesla was doing. He understood this, and he was distributing energy through the ground. That's what Tesla was doing. It is both Wardenclyffe and at his Colorado Springs Research Center. He was lighting up. He would do this at night. He would light up lights all over the desert that were out in the path of electricity by tapping into atmospheric electricity, and which is part of the vertical electric field that is powered by the charge in the ionosphere and maintained there by the dielectric in the Earth's atmosphere. So Tesla understood all of this. And so anyway, he would have light systems out in the desert all the way around this radially. And then as the current went out through the ground, it would light up the light bulbs from the atmospheric electricity. And this was his experiment to distribute electricity for free to the public. And of course, he got shut down. J.P. Morgan and the boys cut his funding because they realized it would invade into their profit, because they were interested in selling oil. That's where the big oil industry, J.P. Morgan, Texaco, Shell, and all the big companies, the Rockefellers, they all invested in money, and they were protecting their turf, their economic turf, because they wanted to sell energy to the public. Remember, back in the early 1900s, every city had a trolley system that was powered by electricity, and that was usually a low-voltage DC, and that was distributed around the city, and the they would have like a wire tracks and kind of a capacitor system in the trolley, but they could go all over town with these electric trolley systems and public transportation, but they in tracks. And I remember as a kid going up to, say, the big city, St. Paul, and after a while there were still some of them left when I was a little kid, just to tell you how far back I go. But they took them all out, and the tracks were still in the streets for a very long time. I think they're all gone now. I don't think there's any streets left with tracks in them. They've all been taken out and covered over. But at that point, there were still tracks all over, and in some cases, even the electric wiring up above that you could see. But they, Ford and those people got in there, and they wanted everybody to have a car, because that was the big market. You sell the Pearson a car, then you sell them the gasoline and the oil and everything else that goes with an automobile. So they pushed that industry, removing public transportation, because back in the early 1900s, not everybody owned a car. Only a very few people owned cars. So that all changed because they took away the public transportation and forced people to buy cars. Okay, so at any rate, the whole reason for talking about this was because I was talking about the space elevator, and that Tesla was trying to build a system that used atmospheric electricity to power things. There's a funny story about Tesla. He was at his Colorado Springs operation one night, and there was a big surge of electricity that came in, and he blew out a generator station that was generating station, I think, with coal at the time, but it had a big generator, electrical generator, and they connected into that and blew it out, and so he had to pay for that. He had to pay for the damage he caused, and so all of these people in the electrical industry knew what he was doing, and he knew that the Earth's frequency, that the distribution would occur at, so he knew with his Wardenclyffe Tower the amount of electricity that would be required. But, of course, Wardenclyffe was very early in Tesla's career. The Colorado Springs place he went to much later to do experimentation with atmospheric electricity. And, of course, my discoveries were relative to Tesla, that where this electricity came from. Tesla knew that there was a vertical electric field. He knew that somewhere up there, there had to be an electrical capacitor. He didn't know how far. He didn't know where it came from. And that's where all my work came from, explaining the where the ionosphere comes from, the electrical charging, the discharge of the solar capacitor, the fact that the Earth is being powered all the time electrically from the capacitor of the sun, the solar capacitor. And so that's where my work came in and did all of this. So I took Tesla's work and expanded it. And, of course, nobody wants me to be able to talk. Of course, I'm heard internationally all the time. But how much do you see? This is one of my points before. You got to turn into my radio show to listen to this. This is not in the New York Times or the Time Magazine or U.S. You know, News and World Report, or it's not in, I don't know if that even exists anymore, or in the public media or anything else, you know, or even in the trade magazines dealing with energy or alternative energy. You will never, ever hear any of this, and you'll never, ever see my name mentioned. Why? Because I have discovered and put this out. You don't have to believe me. You can just read my books. And you will find this also, and anybody with a basic physics understanding can understand this. Well, why doesn't NASA do this? Why doesn't, say, the military pick up on this? Well, to tell you the truth, the military has picked up on this. They stole my work, developed a whole space program based on it. And the reason I know this is because in the early 1980s, I was in Los Angeles looking for funding with my electric propulsion system ideas, etc., and it was all stolen from me by venture capital groups in Los Angeles who moved it into the aerospace companies, etc. And, of course, I worked with the Russian scientists in mid-1990s, and that was very fruitful because we had a lot of collaboration there, understanding things like what causes tornadoes on the surface of the sun, just a little example, or the fact that the sun's core is not hot, it's actually cool. It's a cool planetary surface. Anyway, I'm getting a little bit off track here, but back to orbital dynamics. And, you know, it's actually, I've got about a minute left in my show here, so I'm going to divert a little bit. I'll be picking up this topic next week. I'm going to do quite a few shows on this whole issue. I'll be talking about the 2001 Space Odyssey, space station, you know, the big one that rotates with artificial gravity. I'll be talking about that, etc. But also, just quickly, the powers that be in the world are building up towards a fake alien announcement where they're going to claim that they have been communicating with aliens for a long time. This is coming down the road. They're priming the pump right now, so I'm just giving you a little prelude to that. I think it's going to have to come soon because they're really losing control. They're very much losing control, and the COVID thing and all the other things they planned are not working to their advantage because people are waking up. Anyway, this is the next big scam from the leaders. I'm out of time. Remember to go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and the water filter page, jmccwaterfilters.com. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.